Hello, everybody. This is Dr. Diana Wiley, and I am your host of Love, Lust, and Laughter. My guest, Brad Coates, is somebody that I've known for, oh my goodness, over 20 years. So Brad and I have more of a conversation on the air, and of course we do off the air too. It's more of a conversation than an interview. Welcome back to the program, Brad Coates.
Hey, Dr. Di, how you doing? Good to be back. I always love talking to you.
Well, thank you. It's very mutual. That's why you've been on this program. And then the one I had in Hawaii, I think, more than anybody. So let's tell the audience, remind the audience. I think many of the audience have listened to you before since you've been on a lot of times. But you have a book, Divorce with Decency, now in its fifth edition. And you've been a divorce lawyer in Honolulu, Hawaii for 40 years. And you've actually in
now.
That process.
Amazing,
41.
Huh?
Yep, it is. And you've actually, and this is the reason that I think you're quite an exceptional divorce attorney. You've actually saved some marriages rather than helped them go through a divorce. And you go on cruise ships and other places talking about how to improve your relationship. Talk a little bit about that before we get into our topics for this program.
Well, I think that's the other half of the equation, and one that, frankly, I think way too few divorce lawyers focus on is, frankly, attorneys make more money off of combat than they do off of conciliation, and I've never been a big fan of that. I'm kind of an old 60s hippie kind of guy myself, and I wanted a career where I could do some good, and we've done a lot of good. My book has helped save a lot of marriages, I believe, or I've had that reported back, and certainly I'd do that in my office as well. Or at least people do have to get divorced, at least make it more friendly and more manageable for themselves and for the kids. If people lose track of the fact that how bad kids get hurt in divorce.
They do, and you have, in some of your outlines for me, I believe you've quoted Dr. Judith Wallerstein, and she did some really important longitudinal studies on children of divorce. And
yes.
It started in the 70s. As I recall, she got a big grant from the Ford Foundation. And so she studied these children of divorce and then followed up with these kids all along for like 20 years. So she has some very good data on children of divorce. And either they turn out, as my children have, more resilient, mom's house, dad's house, and making adjustments, or they don't do so well. But the important things are that the mom and the dad do continue to communicate about the children, and they don't make the kids carry messages and all that sort of thing, that the parents talk to each other about the children. And
it's amazing how much, that's what the Wallerstein study showed, how much kids were impacted by divorce, 20, 30, 40 years later. So it is very important how it gets handled, and it's important, that the genders learn to get along. I mean, our topic today is more on an issue of how difficult it may be to bridge the growing gender gap between men and women, because that does seem to be something that is getting worser rather than betterer, if you'll pardon the expression. In modern day society, and with the impact of social media and news media 24 cycles, there's just all this back and forth between the genders, and it's tough, and if you're not careful, it can make the two genders really disagreeable towards one another, and that makes it hard to keep marriages together, and then it makes it hard to do any kind of a divorce with decency because people are pissy, and it's unfortunate, and shows like yours can help people see the light, hopefully.
Yes, and then, well, and reading your book, and I've recommended your book to many of my clients, and clearly the book sells well if it's in its fifth edition, and it's what I like so much about Divorce with Decency is that it's also kind of sociological, and that's actually what we're discussing today, and we've touched on this before, and that is how traditional men's passages And we talked earlier.
I think the last show we did, we talked about, you know, how women were getting much, much stronger in society, both, you know, both economically, their power, you know, their power in everything from the House of Representatives to the to making their own money and outdistancing men in education. I read an interesting fact that we didn't include in our last discussion, which is that nowadays about 70% of all high school valedictorians in recent years have been girls. So we've got a situation where women are definitely getting stronger. And I think what we wanted to try and talk about now is, you know, how are the men doing? And the men may not be doing all that well. I mean, obviously the women's salaries have increased. You know, again, I'm going back to a couple of statistics. Women's earnings grew 44% from 1970 to 2007 versus only 6% growth for men. So women are doing better. There's no question about that. They're assuming more of the power position in the marriages, in the household, in the boardrooms, in relationships, and men are maybe becoming growing a little bit weaker and even becoming slackers as they pass through the life cycle. So there's an interesting aspect to this. There's Dr. John Roseman, who's kind of the authority on a little bit of a hardcore parenting authority, and he wrote an interesting article entitled "Divorce is a Major Contributor to the Collapse of the American Male." And I think you could flip that around and say the collapse of the American male is a major contributor to divorce. You know, men are just kind of wimping out on a lot of the jobs that they used to have, the factory jobs, the industry jobs, despite President Trump's promises to bring them all back, those have been the areas that have been hammered the worst in the economic environment. And so I think a lot of guys are feeling a little lost, and then you throw in a porn addiction and an OxyContin addiction. you've got a real problem potentially for guys to you know, act like men.
And
at least the way men used to be, yeah.
Yes, and we want to. I thought it'd be interesting to talk about traditional masculinity versus what's going on now, and the APA, the American Psychological Association, more than a decade ago, they released a set of guidelines for treating women and girls, and it addressed sexual violence and pay inequality and eating disorders and anxiety and all of that. But what they did not release until very recently was guidelines for treating men. And it's interesting because, and you know, the APA, the American Psychological Association, is pretty powerful. Men were already perceived as the default, sort of unneeding of individual study, because unless you're in a men's group, you're probably not regularly reflecting on what it means to be a male. Men just don't think about this. My husband, many years ago, was in a men's group, and they talked about it, and it really helped, because a lot of men will kind of go along, and do what they feel they have to do as providers, but they don't address the feelings that are underneath very often. You know, we make a lot of general statements, but that sort of, we need to do that in order to make the point, I guess.
Well, it's funny you should mention the American Psychology Association, because they actually published a recent new article where they are defining toxic masculinity, and treating it as a public health crisis, and issuing treatment guidelines in quotes for men and boys, which effectively make men feel even wimpier. it's even more toxic. I mean, you know, their report asserts that the traditional masculinity is as marked by, quote, stoicism, competitiveness, dominance, and aggression, is harmful to both men themselves, to the men themselves, and to society. And then, obviously, the next step is that represents a results in oppression of women and minorities and an epidemic of violence. So all this gets blamed on men. But then the next question is, by telling men that masculinity itself is some sort of a disease and that they need, you know, conversion therapy, does that just serve to drive them away further? It's a
absolutely
two-edged sword.
I see it. Oftentimes when I'm either counseling an individual man or a couple, some of these men are so relieved to be able to talk about their feelings and not have to remain stoic and competitive, to talk about their feelings. And, you know, the feeling is that the more men cling to rigid views of masculinity, the more likely they are to be depressed or disdainful or lonely.
Well, there's no question about that. I mean, you know, episodes of the statistics on male depression, isolation, opioid addiction, alcohol addiction, spousal violence, they're all at national, and male suicides, they're at crisis levels. I mean, you've read the statistics, I'm sure you have, that, you know, our kids are one of the first, the last 3 years have been the life expectancy rate for Americans has decreased. And that's never happened in our nation's history. And now all of a sudden, we're losing more of our young kids, but a lot of them are males, to gang violence, to opioid addiction, to suicide. I mean, it really has turned into a national crisis. And I don't know exactly what the answer is. I'm not sure whether, you know, I mean, obviously telling men not to be men is tricky, but rerouting their traditional vices and turning them into virtues, or you know, getting men to be a little more gentle is obviously smart. But berating them about being men, period, is a tough one. I mean, we've got a senator over here named Mazie Hirono, who is, I know her personally, she's a nice lady, but during the Kavanaugh hearing, she got her back up and this is a Hawaii senator, was broadcast all over nationwide TV telling men to, quote, stand up and shut up, and branding them as misogynists, and you know, I'm not sure guys want to hear quite that much venom directed
tough
at them. Yeah,
it's pretty tough, and guys, anyway, as you point out in terms of the men's passages, and others have pointed out that you need to go from many men to do this passage well. They need to go from competing to connecting.
Exactly. That's a term that Gail Sheehy in her passages book wrote about, and it is absolutely
right.
True. When you think about it, and you and I have had this discussion before, I don't remember if we talked about it on air, but certainly we have a lot of interesting, wide-ranging discussions whenever we see each other here in Hawaii. Basically, if you look at the trajectory of the male life, in youthful adolescence and up through high school and college, it's defined by, you know, belonging to the sports team or excelling at sports or being a, you know, team captain or joining a fraternity of men. And then you go on into the business community, and it's more competing, to go from being I'm a lawyer, from a junior partner to a senior partner in a law firm or whatever up the corporate ladder. And then, you know, when men come out of their professional careers or they start to wane at, you know, 50, 60 years old, then the trick is to go to something new as your male identity, and a lot of guys just don't have it. And that's when you have to go from the competing to the connecting continuum. And women are much, much better at that. And guys have got to learn it. There's no question about it. They've got to learn to be more like, I don't know, Alan Alda or some male figure that really is in touch with his sensitive side, because that's what women are looking for. And not just looking for, it's what women are really demanding now to even stay in relationships or stay married. And women, as I've mentioned before on your show, they're the ones that set the tone as to whether marriages survive, and women file for 2/3 of all divorces, and it's just 80% of all relationships are ended by women. So guys, whether they like it or not, have got to get with the program and understand that they've got to be, you know, more in touch with their feminine side, more communicative, all these things that women, need and expect now. You can't just be a macho guy anymore. So
there was a psychiatrist named Steven Bergman, and along with his wife, they conducted workshops and research at the Stone Center at Wellesley College for many years, starting in 1981, and they were looking at this very thing about competing to connecting, and they point out that disconnecting is learning how not to listen, how not to register the feelings inside oneself or expressed by others, how to turn off in order to remain in control and get the job done. So, these are all challenging as a man tries to experience, for some men, personal growth. But a lot of men do discover, and I know you know this, the healing power of mutual relationships for both men and women. Mutual relationships. And so we're going to talk some about that as we go along.
Well, women want the sort of elusive, sensitive, communicative male, and it pays, as a guy, it pays to learn funny little things like the fact that whereas women have, 20,000 communication expressions a day, everything from rolled eyes to spoken word to shrugged shoulders to whatever, and guys only have 7,000. I mean, women communicate at a rate that's like three times that of guys. And if guys can't, get a little bit of the background on this and try and figure it out, they are not going to be able to keep their woman's attention. That's really what it comes down to, especially now that she has so many more options.
Yeah, so that's a pretty good, in terms of keeping a woman's attention, it's a pretty good segue into sexuality, my favorite topic.
I knew we'd get to that eventually.
Yeah, well, and you write it up in your outline, too, of course. And we could even talk about in the context of marriage, because let's back up a little bit before we talk about sexuality. And I want to say before we back up that loss of sexual desire most often results from problems or power struggles in a couple's relationship. But let's back up because you talk about save your life wife. So expand on that and why men are more dependent, really, I guess, on women than many believe. Can you expand on that?
Well, there's no question, but what I've done probably, 30,000. Well, I haven't personally. I've got 11 lawyers in the Coates, Fry, Tanimoto, and Gibson law firm, which is the biggest divorce firm here in Hawaii. I've been doing it for 40 years, and we've probably done 30,000 divorces here, and I personally have done, 7,000 or 8,000 of them. Every time you divorce a guy, obviously not every time, but, most every time that you divorce a guy, he will be looking for a new woman to, because guys are not great at being alone, even taking care of themselves, whatever. They're more serious about sex. They're more serious about, wanting good cooking. They're more serious about everything that women can provide. And guys will immediately start looking for another woman. Statistics show that, guys are likely, if they get divorced or break out of a relationship, they're likely to get into another relationship within another 2 to 3 years. They'll be remarried. Women,
yes, that's right. Whether it's divorced or widowed.
Women, it's several years, if at all. And a lot of times, women don't even want to get remarried. They basically had it with taking care of guys, and they're not interested in prolonging the agony anymore. So a lot of times you won't even see women think about hooking up with another guy, but guys almost always do. And it turns out that men need women much more, especially as they age out. Invariably, men need women a partner more than women need men. What happens is that women have a lengthier, more specific set of important criteria, whereas guys just want to. They just want to, have a gal holding them and being with them and making love to them, so it is tricky because going back to your sexual focus, which, like, I have never been on a show of yours where we don't wind up in the middle of that somewhere along the line.
Name of my show is Love, Lust, and Laughter.
Well, and that is an interesting phenomena, and it may be getting even more interesting because statistics have shown that 60% of men, but only about 35% of women, say sexual activity is more important to their lives. And we know that guys can have orgasms fast, whereas women prefer foreplay. We know all this stuff, but chemistry may be making it even weirder, especially for what they call gray divorces, which is the most rapidly increasing cohort of any age group. There's more people that are getting divorced in their 60s than there ever were before. 25% of all recent divorces involve people who've been married for over 20 years, just when you think that they're going to be... marriages are going to be stable. And currently, one in every four Americans who gets divorced is 50 years or older, and that was like one in 10 in 1990. So older people getting divorced, and think of what's happening with the sexuality of I'm sure you've thought of this, and you can expound upon it, but think of what's happening with the sexuality of older people. It used to be that both genders' sexual appetite sort of declined simultaneously with age. As you got older, everybody kind of ran out of gas, sort of at the same time, both women and men. Nowadays, men, sort of unlike women, can continue to feel sexual through chemistry, through they call them the Viagra divorces. You know, men wanting sexuality longer than they used to. Women are just about ready to wipe their brow and say, thank God, I don't have to put up with this anymore. Then all of a sudden he's got a Viagra prescription and we're back in the race again. And men are, they get even, they're always weirder sexually, and porn's making them weirder, but when you think of what Viagra does, it makes men immediately erect and immediately ready to have sex, whereas, women have always wanted more foreplay, and it almost is exacerbating the problem. That's why a lot of leading women's liberation figures have called Viagra a curse for women. So now as you get older, you've got more of a focus on a sexual divide than ever before, and it was always tricky to bridge that divide. I'm sure you've got plenty to say on that.
Absolutely. Yes.
I thought you might.
Well, it's when an older couple can agree to be intimate, to be sexual, and it may not be the same form as it was maybe 30 years before, but when they can agree to be sexual, the bond is so strong. It increases the bond. And for many of these couples, the empty nest, their kids have gone, becomes indeed the love nest. And they have more time, and there's that gender crossover to return to the theme of today, the gender crossover. So men become, after 50, sometime in the 50s, and this is Gail Sheehy's passages, but so men become a little more their feminine side, their anima, in terms of the Jungian ideas. The anima becomes stronger, so they're more communicative. They take their time. They slow down. They're more sensitive. They don't have to ejaculate every single time. They're just enjoying the intimacy. Now, this can also happen for a man who is on the second go-round, or maybe the third, in terms of marriage. A woman's masculine side, the animus, can emerge, where she's more willing to say what she desires, what she wants, her needs, and she also is often a little more confident about initiating sex, which makes a lot of men really happy. Of course, that's the best case scenario. There are plenty of worst case, and I see them in my office.
Well, one of the things that can help increase the likelihood of the best case scenario prevailing is to understand this stuff. I've read that women actually start to produce testosterone as they get older. So understanding that the biology of this is important, and the genders, if they can have this stuff, I mean, that's what I try and do in my law practice. If they can try and understand each other, what each gender is going through, that increases the likelihood of you know, managing to bridge that gap. But left to their own devices, I'm afraid that men and women are you know, on a track to go separate directions, and that may be really problematic for society.
I agree with you. I absolutely agree with you, because I think we need each other.
Yeah.
You know, and Wallerstein studies even showed, you may remember from reading them, that he needs, this came out in her studies, the man needs a maternal female figure to depend on. And that's why often there is a woman in the wings when he decides to get a divorce. And spouses are, many men will say that spouses are their primary source of intimacy and comfort. So if a man is left without a spouse for intimacy and comfort, he naturally is going to try to find somebody else, to another woman. Pretty quickly, more quickly than a woman, as you pointed out earlier in this show, and we've talked about it a little bit in the previous shows. It really turns a lot of older women off when a man is looking for, and I've used this expression before, it's not original, a nurse with a purse. That turns off a lot of women. They don't want to be, I mean, they may be financially independent and they're happy, but they don't want to be nursing a man. So...
Yeah.
It's all very complicated.
Well, and, you read the demographics. I mean, there's four widows for every one widower.
Yes.
The average age for widowhood is 56 years old, which astounded me when I first read that. I mean, that seems way young.
And that's how old I was exactly when Charlie died, and you knew Charlie. I mean, I was a widow at 56.
Knew him and loved him, yeah.
Yeah. It's, and then... As you know, because Brian and I were in Hawaii last December, and we celebrated Brian's birthday there, which was fun, with you and your significant other and other couples that we know. It was such a nice time to be with you. But you know, Brian is a man who's done a lot of personal work. He has a lot of self-awareness. And even my daughter said, "Oh, Mom, your husband is so grounded." And my daughter can be very critical. You know my daughter a little bit from years ago. So it's possible for men to emerge and change and grow stronger and better if they decide to do the personal work.
Think how hard that is for guys. I mean, you know, I think you're exactly right. That is what men need to do, and it's almost what women have come to expect. But guys are totally wired to do the opposite. You know, we don't talk about anything. You know, we keep it all in. We don't have, you know, boyfriends, guy friends, the way women have their girlfriends to chat with.
Mm,
I mean, you know, it's really, you know, it's weird. I mean, you know, my father taught me zero about women or sexuality when I was growing up. I mean, I think, you know, guys, just the traditional males, they just, you know, they stay in their cave and they don't get real introspective. They certainly don't get very verbal about it. And that's what we talk about, where the essential task for men at midlife is to move from competing to connecting, because that is absolutely essential, but hard to do for a lot of guys.
So I think you sent me this study. I should have made note of it, how I got it, but it's the title is How Traditional Masculinity Hurts the Men Who Believe in It Most. And she, Monica Hess, opens with, "My grandfather is traditionally masculine in most senses of the word. He was a soldier, and then a bait shop owner, then a garbage collector. He rose before dawn most days of his life, and I never heard him complain about it. He raised 6 good kids. He tells funny one-liners. He's an expert fisherman. He once refused over-the-counter pain meds while he was on death's door." And then she finishes up the article by saying how much she loved and respected her grandfather, how most everyone who met him respected him, how our family story centered on him being a good provider and a good man, but also how I couldn't remember anyone asking my grandfather how he felt about that, whether he would have preferred a different life, whether he had ever felt trapped in the one he had. They didn't know that. That was more traditional masculinity back in the day.
Well, you hear about these people, and, you know, my father was one of them, you know, the greatest generation, fought in World War II and had all kinds of just, you know, totally life, you know, wrenching experiences as they watched guys get shot right next to them. And a lot of guys never talked about it. They came back and never talked about it. And you know, so it just shows how you know, sort of suck it up, keep it internalized, and that's the mark of a real man. You don't cry, you don't express emotion, whereas women want, that's exactly what women do want. They want guys that do talk about everything and are willing to express their emotions. And so we are on a bit of a collision course between the genders. And like I say, what's happening even more, you know, strangely is that with women's growing power, the hashtag Me Too movement, I mean, you know, you hear enough women on TV talk about how horrible men are, you know, A, women are going to begin to believe it, and B, guys are going to begin to resent it. So, you know, I mean, you can't have that kind of exposure to a 24/7 news cycle, which is deliberately polarizing everybody. I mean, I've never seen the nation as polarized, in all respects as it is nowadays. And now the genders have started to jump in and do the same thing. So it's problematic, to say the least.
Very much so. And, some of these folks feel like, well, we've got to fix the men. Some feel like we've got to fix women, because as soon as women stop taking their jobs, then the men won't be depressed anymore. And as soon as women would stop categorizing sexual attention as harassment, well, then the men wouldn't be lonely anymore. So these are fixes that some men are imagining, but they're really hard to navigate and to make it happen.
Your example is exactly right. You know, I mean, attention as harassment. I mean, it used to be that a guy, and that was kind of the standard that was almost expected. You know, you were in a bar, a guy's supposed to approach the woman. He's supposed to have a clever line. He's supposed to buy her a drink. He's supposed to, you know, compliment her on how she looks. I don't know. I've never all that successful in bars, so I don't know. But I mean, the impression was that an alpha male was supposed to come on to a woman, and now that's harassment. So you know.
Yeah.
I don't know.
That'd be very confusing to a lot.
Maybe I'm just an old fart and can't quite adjust fast enough, but this is really, really kind of a bizarre phenomenon, if you ask me.
Well, I think it is, and I think it's very confusing to lots of men, especially younger men, but even older men who've lived with a different sort of standard. I can remember many times when I was in my 20s and single and a pretty young woman, where men would come on to me, even in the workplace, inappropriately, and I just handled it. You know, sometimes I said, "Well, thank you for your attention. That's very nice, but you know, I don't want it to go any further," or you know, something like that. I took charge. I was not a victim, and I think a lot of the women who, I'm making a generalization, but I think, and I'm not denying that a lot of them are suffering. But I think a lot of women, if they could just take charge a little bit better and stand up to a man and not just lie down and be a doormat, they'd do better. But I'm from another generation, as you are. So
it's there's another aspect of all this that is you know, I'm no expert on this, but you know, it seems like with so much animosity growing between the two traditionally recognized genders, you've got something called gender fluidity that's arising, where, you know, where kids are just trying to be more androgynous or bi-gender, and, you know, not adopting either gender. And that is, you know, that's a trend that's, you know, above my pay grade, because I'm, like I say, I'm a little too old and rickety to think in terms of that. But you see it all the time now where, you know, on official government forms, you don't have to just check an M or an F anymore. And, you know, I saw Delta Airlines is saying, oh, you don't have to declare your gender anymore. So that's, you know, maybe that's where this is all going to lead, is to some kind of weird blending of the genders where, you know, traditional, you know, gender role models sort of disappear in altogether. I don't know.
Well, I think it's hard for those of us who are well over 50 and 60 to kind of get a handle on this. It's really hard. But I do think there is some advantage for trans people to have more acceptance, because the suicide rate is the highest for transgendered people. So more acceptance and understanding of transgendered people, and certainly for lesbians and male gays, the LGBT community, we need to have a better understanding and of those folks. But I think it's very confusing for a lot of us who are older to have this gender identity problem. And the fluidity, as you point out, the fluidity.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, I mean, the traditional masculine and female roles, you know, were kind of biologically wired in order to, you know, preserve humanity. I mean, the idea was that, you know, that men were supposed to want women, and that would cause them to propagate, and women were, you know, were supposed to, you know, be women and you know, ready to raise the children and or at least bear the children. And you know, I mean, if you get a situation where you've got a bunch of people literally denying their prior genders, I wonder what that does for the survival of the species. But I don't know. I'm not a philosopher. It's certainly a long ways away from, you know, what Charles Darwin would have thought about as far as the evolutionary cycle. So I don't know.
You have some interesting points, Brad, about the evolutionary theory of cheating. And I think we should veer off into that a little bit, because we both like the book Sex at Dawn by Dr. Christopher Ryan. But the sexual hardwiring of each gender since the dawn of time. But do you want to expand on that a little bit? The males remain.
Yeah. I mean, it's pretty well known. You know, the evolutionary theory of cheating basically centers around the fact that males who remain faithful can produce only a few offspring. Conversely, unfaithful males produce a far larger number of their own kind. You know, a guy who sleeps with a different woman every night can produce hundreds of offspring, whereas a guy who stays faithfully married and a good husband and, you know, produces 2.2 kids or whatever, you know, that was what, you know, in the old days, Genghis Khan would roll through a village you know, kill all the men and impregnate all the women, and that was the Mormons. That was the root of Mormon polygamy. They may or may not have been able to settle the unsettleable portions of the Old West had they not figured out a way to really, you know, spawn a lot of offspring. And so you've got a situation where unfaithful males produce larger numbers and gives them a distinct biological advantage. Faithful males don't produce as many of their own kind. So again, you get selective breeding where, again, survival of the fittest, the alpha males, you know, have an advantage. And there's no advantage on the other end of the equation for a female to have more than one mate. She can only be pregnant, you know, once every 9 months. And actually, it can work to her disadvantage to be unfaithful, because if her primary mate doesn't stick around, there's nobody to, you know, grab a club and fend off the saber-toothed tiger at the mouth of the cave. So I think Sex at Dawn, you're right, Christopher Ryan's book is the best description of biological sexual hardwiring, you know, that's gone on of each gender since literally the dawn of time. And now, really within the last, you know, 50 or 60 years, we're messing with that. And it is... you know, it remains to be seen where all this leads.
He also points out, and he wrote the book, let's remember, with his wife, a psychiatrist, and her name is hard to pronounce. I've met them both, and they're just incredible people. And in fact, Christopher Ryan, when his book Sex Lived On first came out, was on this program. So that must be 6-7 years ago now. But it's such a well-researched book, and he points out that up until the agricultural revolution, everything was shared in communities, including sexual partners. You know, there wasn't property as such. And that men would line up and wait for their turn to, well, I just use the word because I can use it on this radio show, or couldn't on a network thing, but wait their turn to fuck a woman. And that is later expressed in some of the pornography where you have men watching other men have intercourse with a woman. So according to Dr. Ryan, it goes way back, that men are hardwired for that too, that they get turned on by watching another man have sex with a woman, and maybe even several men watching. Did you know that, Brad? Did you know that?
I had an inkling of that, but you phrase it better than I would have thought. I mean, I didn't know about the agricultural communities and that, but I mean, you know, I mean, I certainly porn. I know enough. I'm not a porn addict, thank God, but I did enough research on porn in writing the and in each. I mean, I've been writing Divorce with Decency book. It's in it, like I say, fifth edition. I mean, we didn't even. I don't think I even covered the topic of porn in the or the internet dating or any of this other stuff back when I first
you
wrote it in the late 90s.
Because I had you on my program when your first edition first came out, when I lived in Hawaii and saw your article in the Honolulu Advertiser or whatever, or they did an interview with you, and I called you up and I said, I would like to talk to you on my radio show. So that was our first interview.
25 years later, we're still doing it, yeah.
And we're still doing it. Isn't that great?
It's fantastic.
But no, your first edition had nothing. What?
You become a great friend in the process, and it's fantastic.
Oh.
But in those days, you know, porn was something you got it out of a video store and took out in a brown paper wrapper. Now it's all you can do to keep it out of the hands of your 12-year-old kid off of her iPhone, you know. So that is a problem in many ways too. I mean, I think probably if you could have couples watching soft porn and it got them excited, or maybe even hard porn, you know, that might help fix a deficit in a sex deprived marriage. But what we really are seeing happen a lot is that it's more men than women watch porn, and a lot of it is really degrading to the women, and it really objectifies women and treats them as objects. You talk about, you know, watching, you know, three or four men, you know, rotate through one woman. That I don't think that probably makes most women feel very, very horny or happy. And you know, now we see it in, you know, like in Japan, where they've gone totally wacko, you know, where a lot of Japanese women don't want to marry Japanese men. The Japanese robotics industry is at the cutting edge of sex with robotic dolls. They've got a birth rate that is too low to restock their own country. I mean, you know, it is really you talk about a gap between the genders. That society has gone, you know, totally off the deep end as far as Japanese women not wanting to have a lot to do with Japanese men, and Japanese men going to the Ginza and you know, hiring women or bar girls or geishas don't really exist anymore so much, but you know, the whole trend of having, you know, paid for sex or video sex or robotic sex as opposed to real. You know, what you preach, and it, you know, and I could not agree more. There is nothing that can cement a relationship better than a good, caring, serious, giving and sharing sexual relationship, and you know, that should be high on everybody's list. I took a Viagra. I'm ready, and you just, you know, I'm just going to shove it somewhere. That's not the kind of communicative, holding and touching and, you know, feeling communicative kind of a relationship that you know, you're hoping for in sexuality. And I'm afraid that, you know, that there may, you know, be more of a drift towards the former rather than the latter, I guess.
The fear of intimacy truly is sometimes the fear of getting too deep into yourself. Because in a relationship, it's a mirror. And maybe the guy thinks on some level, he may not be conscious of it, I'm afraid to look at the old jock image of myself and find out, hey, you're not really that good. So sometimes the fear of intimacy is the fear of looking at oneself. I want to circle back to Japan because, as you know, in the early 90s, I made about 4 trips to Japan and I studied the Japanese swallows, so-called swallows. They're the guy geishas. And I went to this club, AI is love, several times, and it was fascinating. Dr. Ishikawa, who taught at the University of Tokyo, was thrilled that I was doing this study on this population because he said the guy geishas have not been studied before. So I'm with a translator. I made several trips to Club I, got to know some of the guy geishas and then the manager of, and then I later gave them a questionnaire that was translated from English to Japanese to find out what they really wanted and needed, and they were so what the questionnaires revealed is that these guys were happy. They felt like they were doing their country a favor because they were giving attention to the women. And a lot of, I interviewed one of the wives. Her husband would drop her off at the club because he was guilty for not giving his wife attention. He was traveling the world and making a lot of money, so he'd drop her off. But so you're right. So even back in the early 90s when I did this work, this research, a lot of Japanese women, including my translator, who was then in her early 40s, didn't want to marry a Japanese man.
Yeah. that's common.
And so, you know, the three words, the man, this is a stereotypical thing, but the man would come home and say three words in Japanese, of course, dinner, massage, bath, sleep. And more than that, he expected his wife to do all that for him. And so a lot of women didn't want to be bound by this sort of thing. So, and I think it's just progressed so that more and more. I actually have a Japanese client married to a woman who's Malaysian. And when his mother visits, he doesn't remember being touched at all growing up. And when his mother visits from Japan, they don't even hug then. So part of the work I've done with him is to help him get over his touch adversity. So, yes, not to harp on Japan, but you brought it up, but there are a lot of problems with intimacy, with sexuality, and that's why it's much easier to just do the sex dolls and do the, right, all of those things that don't require real human-to-human contact.
Well, there, you know, Japan is a society, you know, very male dominant still. Most of the, you know, the Japanese women are talented, educated, and should really be in the boardrooms of major Japanese corporations. But that's almost non-existent in Japan. Japanese women are, you know, they're doing, you know, flower arranging and tea ceremonies, and that's about it. And which is crazy. And again, you get that gap too wide, and it gets hard to bridge it. I mean, you know, no wonder Japanese women don't want to stick around in that situation. And you know,
especially if they're
concern
educated.
The concern I've got for us here in America is you know, we've got these long lifespans now. where they, you know, it's hard enough to keep a relationship together. There's all kinds of people that say that the elongated lifespans alone call for a different partner for every different stage of life. And you've got other tectonic changes of the modern ages, you know, the decline of religion, which used to be a stabilizing force for society.
Mm-hmm.
So instead, you've got, and then you've got the unstoppable impact of technology, which is making it easier to go your own separate way. What do they call it? It used to be broadcasting when you had Uncle Walter just read you the news, and you just, that's the news for a night. Now, now if you listen to Fox and then you listen to CNN, it's like you're, on two different planets. Everybody's able to kind of zero in on whatever, unique and little niche they want to occupy, and there's very few people relatively fewer people that reach out to try and understand, all the different aspects of the world at large. And the more people sort of cocoon up into their own little program, especially, I've had clients come in and say, hey, I need a divorce. I go, why is your, what's the problem? Is your, lack of communication, your husband cheating on you, whatever? She goes, well, no, I haven't caught him cheating per se, but every time I come into his office and he's got his computer screen up, and as soon as I walk in the door, he slams it shut. I'm getting sick of that, and I know he's watching porn, it's like each gender sort of gone into its own little cocoon, and that can't be good. I mean, there's got to be an ability to bridge these gaps, or we're gonna have a potential problem similar to Japan's.
I agree with you. And the other thing about older men that we haven't really talked about is some of them are avoiding sex with their partners because they're having erectile dysfunction, the ED, and they don't really want to talk about it or deal with it with their wives. And I remember I was in Hawaii.
Hey, I'm 68, and I don't want to talk about it.
Oh, yeah, but
it hurts my ears when you even mention that term. No, I know what you're saying. It is, that's an issue. And again, you can't. It's not like you can go to your partner and say, "Hey, I've got a problem maintaining an erection," and really, it's not you. But, let's go to sex therapy about that. You keep all that, bottled up inside in your, in your psyche and in your pants, and you don't talk about it. And she wonders if it's her problem. And I don't know. The genders have got, the key is they've got to learn to communicate better. That's, that is a very essential key. And there's a lot more to it than that, but that's a good place to start.
And I think that men who are prepared, not scared, will be able to protect their health and prolong their potency, probably indefinitely, if they do the right things about their health and exercise and diet, and erections are good for erections. So there's no reason why a man in his who's past 60, past 70, even past 80, because Dr. Walter Bortz and I did studies in the Bay Area in the early 90s. This is before Viagra. And we gave them questionnaires. So there were some 2,000 men who belonged to SIR, Sons in Retirement. And so what we found out is that if a man still was able to get erections and had an interested partner, then he and a partner who might know he might need a little more stimulation to get that erection with her hand, with her mouth, and the relationship has to be good. A man just can't pop a Viagra, get an erection, he won't get an erection unless he maybe has some help from his partner, unless he's really young, and it's used, of course, on porn sets a lot, but we're talking about older relationships, so the man really needs to have a partner who is wanting him and wanting sex, and that's a problem for a lot of older people. But when older people do keep going, they're very happy, say I, with glowing.
You're projecting is what's going to happen once you get older. Yeah, you're exactly right. But again, there's a gender divide in that too, because you, so far, unless you, maybe you know more about this than I do, but you know, you, what you've seen is that Viagra and its cohorts are maybe solving this problem for men and allowing them to can stay sexy into, as you say, the 60s, 70s, 80s. But as far as I know, there isn't anything really comparable for women. They talked about maybe Viagra for women, but I've never heard that catch on. Have you heard anything about that?
I've been following it, and there have been all kinds of PDE5 inhibitors, which are the class for Viagra, Cialis, Levitra, and the many others. And Pfizer, they were declared that Viagra was fine by there has been nothing for women. They've tried all kinds of things. Pfizer worked with a former colleague of mine, Dr. Jennifer Berman, and she was part of that study. And it just doesn't work for women. I tried one just because I'm so healthy and my libido and everything. Because when I was at UCLA, it's Female Sexual Medicine Center, and I tried one, and yes, it increases the blood flow to the genitals, but you have to be, as a woman, very much aware of the blood flow to your genitals, and you have to be in a good relationship.
Yeah, I think that's one of the keys.
It doesn't work for a woman. The relationship is the thing for women.
Women actually, my experience, my limited experience with women is that they really need to feel it in order to feel sexy. I mean, I suppose there's, you know, in college maybe, you know, you get drunk and you're, you know, ready to go no matter what. But over the long haul, women have to feel, including married women that have been married a long time and are maybe losing that, you know, that sense of caring for their husbands or whatever, they have to feel, real love in order to make love, whereas guys can just get an erection and stick it somewhere. There's a big difference. Women have higher expectations and are more serious people and are they're more emotional. They there's a whole different level of caring that women have that guys don't. Which makes it what's making them so successful in society nowadays. Women are taking over. California's got a new statute. You got to put a minimum number of women on board of directors in major corporations, and a lot of law firms are they prefer women managing partners because they can deal with people better. I hope that we can bridge it somehow.
We will. Brad, thanks so much for another great show. You'll be back soon.
I love you, Dr. Brian. Aloha to your audience.
And thank you, and aloha to you and to everybody else. Bye-bye. My boy getting top, 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 top. My boy getting top, 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 top. Happy feet.